Welcome to WKCR FM New York, WKCR HD1. Currently listening to Afternoon New Music. I'm delighted to welcome to the studio today Victoria Bond.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks a lot for coming by. For those of you who don't know, Bond is quite an accomplished conductor, concert organizer, and composer herself. She's been commissioned by the American Ballet Theater, Pennsylvania Ballet, Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival, just to name a few. Notably, she's also the first woman awarded a doctorate in orchestral conducting from the Juilliard School, which she has also taught at, in addition to teaching at the Conductors Institute, New York University. She's also served as the music director of the New Amsterdam and Roanoke Symphony Orchestras, the artistic director of Opera Roanoke, Harris Opera, again, just to name a few. She's done quite a bit. She's also worked with Andre Previn, Pierre Boulez, and Aaron Copland, again, just to name a few. And of course, she's also a concert organizer, which brings us to the main subject of today's discussion, which is the 20th anniversary of the Cutting Edge Concert New Music Festival. I guess before talking about this current iteration and all that's going to be going on there, I was wondering if you could give some of our listeners insight into the significance of this 20-year anniversary by shedding some light on the history of the concert series. Some pretty amazing composers have come through, including yourself, Joan Tower, Pauline Oliveros, Ben Johnston. I guess, how did this all get started? What are some of the highlights, the changes that you've seen? I'd love to hear from
you. Wow, how much time do you have?
Oh boy, we've got 75 minutes on this disc, so I'm sure we'll cover a little bit of what there is.
Sure, yeah. I'll give you a thumbnail sketch. Yeah. I was the music director in Virginia for a number of years, and when I came back to New York, I wanted to reconnect with my friends, my musical friends, and Greenwich House had something called North River Series, and they asked me if I would do a concert of my music, and of course I was delighted, and invited my friends to be on the program, and invited all of my friends to be in the audience. And this was in 1997, and Greenwich House was very pleased with the concert. We had a terrific audience, and they proposed a concert series, and they said, would you consider doing a series of three concerts, and including your own music, but having other composers on the program as well? And I said, yes, of course, that's a great idea. And so that's how the idea of Cutting Edge Concerts, which was not called Cutting Edge Concerts at that time, that's how the idea was born. And so in 1998, I started the series, and it was called Close Encounters at that time because Greenwich House is a very, the euphemism is intimate space, which means it's small,
yeah.
And the audience and the performers are very close together, which actually was a huge plus for us in the beginning because it gave us this kind of living room feeling. Of what chamber music was originally about, which was that it took place in somebody's home. And it felt almost as though I were inviting guests to my home and we were just having a lovely musical evening. And so the idea of chatting with the composers in front of the audience was born at that time. And it created this very kind of casual ambiance, but there was nothing casual about the music making. My friends were extraordinary musicians. I graduated from Juilliard and kept in touch with them. And so the playing level was very high, and I knew many composers, being a composer myself. And so the musical level was high, but the ambiance was friendly and comfortable. And I felt that was very important because oftentimes new music can be off-putting to an audience, something unfamiliar and something that they're a little bit wary of. So this was a way of demystifying it. And from the very beginning, my friends were so cooperative. I think Joan Tower was one of the first people that we had on the series, and I've known her since we were both in school, and she's also very funny, so that helped. It just gave a kind of a, you know, a comfortable looseness to the conversation part of it, and we have kept that, even though we moved to Symphony Space in the Thalia Theater, which is larger than Greenwich House was. But still, the ambiance has that sense of an intimate space.
That's interesting. There's some operas at the Cutting Edge Concert Series, right? I guess traditionally one might think of operas as being in these really big grand halls, these really giant spectacles. And I guess in combination with other forms of new music, there is something that can be quite intense about it. You know, we bring in first years here sometimes and we say, okay, this is new music. It's not just like recent top 30 releases. It's this really intense, challenging stuff. So I guess, is that something that you take into consideration when you're making pieces or composing the space that it's going to be performed in?
Absolutely. That's a very important factor. And, you know, opera in the 21st century does not necessarily mean grand opera. Opera can be really just a couple of players and a few instruments, a couple of singers and a few instruments. There are a lot of spaces that are now producing opera that are very small. And yes, indeed, your question is a very because we have to take into consideration the space. In the Thalia Theater, we have to take out several rows of seats in order to create a pit because there is no pit in that theater. So, for example, the operas that we're going to do on May 1st involve a chamber ensemble, the Cygnus Ensemble, of six instruments. And one thing I want to mention in the kind of groups that we have been working with lately is that they are existing new music groups, which is a much better option than having to put together players. There are times when I do have to create an ensemble from disparate players, but New York being a place where musicians who are working are very busy, it's always hard to find to be able to schedule things. But the operas that we put on, including operas that we've done in the past, we did, as a matter of fact, on our very first season, we worked with Encompass Music Theater, and we put on a work of Bill Balcom's, who is going to be performing tonight at the American Opera Center, and other works, and we did them in a smaller ensemble.
Cool. I definitely would love to hear more about the Cygnus Ensemble. And I believe there was another ensemble. Which ensemble is performing on April 24th again?
Yes, we have two. We're dividing the concert in half. The first half is Taka Kigawa, who is a pianist very, very well known for his specialization in contemporary music. And so he'll be doing a work of Richard Carrick, Zosia DeCastri, and Sean Shepard. And then on the second half of the program, we have the String Orchestra of New York. So it'll be a larger ensemble, and they perform without conductor, like the Orpheus Ensemble. And they're going to be doing a work of Lisa Bielawa and one of my own works, which actually both Lisa and I have arranged our respective works for the String Orchestra of New York. My work was originally for a mixed ensemble, but I've arranged it for just for strings.
I guess one of the big questions here at WKCR in our new music department is what exactly we're talking about when we say new music. And I feel like the title of your concert series, Cutting Edge, kind of gives us a good sense that, you know, it's something new, something challenging. But at the same time, this is the 20th year of being on the cutting edge. So how does one stay on the cutting edge for 20 years?
Well, it's interesting. Cutting edge means different things to different people. To some people, it means strictly avant-garde. You know, if it doesn't involve electronics and film, it's not cutting edge. But my definition of cutting edge is something that's being written now. And the cutting edge can be music that refers to the past or music that destroys the past. So I'm rather omnivorous, shall we say, in my acceptance of many different styles of contemporary music. And I think that has been to the benefit of the Cutting Edge Concert Series because it has allowed us a very wide margin of different styles and different philosophies. And actually, I like to put them together on the same concert so that people can say, well, here we are in the year 2017, and look at the diversity of styles that we're listening to that are being composed the day before yesterday.
I think that's a good segue, actually, into talking about some of your own pieces. It's going to be a premiere of Sirens at one of the upcoming concert series, I believe the last.
May 1st.
May 1st, yeah. And that's inspired by a passage from Joyce. However, in another one of your pieces, Soul of a Nation, also inspired by a text from Thomas Jefferson, correct? you took directly from the text to form the libretto, and the music was also inspired by Baroque pieces in Jefferson's own library. So there's some interesting play with referring back and forth to different pieces of time, I guess.
Jefferson was a very fine violinist. He did not play in public, but he played for his own enjoyment. And in his library, there was a work by Corelli, and I thought, how perfect to be able to use this as a theme for a set of variations.
Is that a theme that you enjoy exploring especially, or is that something that comes up in a lot of your music, I guess, reference back to previous works and then also the works within those works that...
That's
are
right.
being referenced.
I like found objects, and I consider musical references found objects. And James Joyce is just full of these because he himself was a very fine singer, a tenor. And in Ulysses, he makes reference to hundreds and hundreds of works, some of which he sang and others which are just pertinent to the particular passage. And Sirens, the Sirens episode from Ulysses, is considered to be the most musical episode in the entire book because it involves basically men at a bar singing. And it's not a contest, but they're kind of trying to outdo one another. And our hero, Leopold Bloom, is sitting in the next room listening to what is going on. And, of course, it pertains very much to the overall story of Ulysses.
That's interesting. So the sirens are actually men in Joyce's story.
No, actually, the sirens are two barmaids, and he calls them gold and bronze. And they are really the reference point to the sirens in Ulysses, in the original Ulysses. But the men come into the bar, and they're all attracted to these young ladies, and so they don't get killed on the rocks or anything like that. Although I don't know, maybe if they drink enough, they will be.
Amazing. So how does So you find this awesome passage from James Joyce and many opportunities to do that in his work. I guess, how do you take the next step of then saying, okay, let's translate this into an opera?
Well, actually, the first one I did was the Molly Bloom Soliloquy, which is the very last episode in Ulysses. And it's something like 250 pages without any punctuation. And this was not necessarily just an invention of James Joyce. It's evidently the way his wife wrote. She was not exactly literary. And so this big run-on sentence is very much her personality. And that's the first one I set. That was a huge challenge because to boil that down, the piece is 45 minutes, and to boil that down from what would have taken about maybe 2 hours on stage for one singer, which would be a lot, I had to do a lot of judicious cutting. And in Sirens, which is a whole chapter, it's also quite long, I also had to do a lot of cutting and to decide what I thought would work on stage, because there are many references. The fascinating and challenging thing about Sirens, Joyce said he wrote it like a verbal fugue, and that's that there are many things that are happening simultaneously, although in words you can't have one piled on top of the other as you can in music. But even in music, it would be very difficult to be able to disentangle everything that's going on. So I had to make a decision of what I thought was going to be clear enough for an audience to follow, as it were, the progression, not so much of a storyline, but the progression of events that happen in this bar.
So what instruments on that, and how many vocalists do you have trying to work on this?
I have four singers. Two of them are the two barmaids, and the other two are a tenor and a baritone. And the two men take on various roles. If I were going to cast this for a larger situation, I would have many more men, because there are a lot of men that come into this bar and that are working simultaneously. But for this particular production, if I can say, it's a concert really, just the two men plus an actor who's actually a singer with a beautiful speaking voice, who is going to be doing the narration that is interwoven into the singing portions.
Interesting. So I guess you talked a little bit about just how knowing some of these people personally from studies or your musical career has led to them being involved in both this show and prior shows. I'm guessing, how else do you find all these really great artists to come to the show, and especially performers? I guess I'm guessing that there's not a lot of performers running around New York ready to sing these like challenging Joyce
actually,
pieces.
Well, actually, there are. You know, New York is such a magnet for artists. It's an abundance of talent here. So I go to a lot of concerts. I try and keep up on everything that's going on as far as performers, as far as composers, read all the blogs, all the reviews in the papers, and as I say, attend as many events as I can throughout the year. So I try and keep my ear to the ground, as it were, to see who's doing what and who I like. And then again, there are all the people I've worked with. There's this kind of a team that that continues to get larger and larger and larger of people that I've worked with, that I enjoy working with, and that I want to continue working with.
Cool. So again, this is the 20th anniversary of the concert series, I guess. Is there anything special happening to commemorate the anniversary, or maybe
alive.
It's already happened?
I mean, longevity in this profession is sometimes gauged in days and months, not in decades. So, I mean, to have arrived at two decades is very festive. And our wonderful publicist, Gail Wine, has been very instrumental in making sure that as many people out there as possible know about this, and doing things like your show and various articles. We're going to have a lovely article in New Music Box coming up. And that all helps to celebrate and make it a very festive year.
Woo! I'm glad. Glad we could be a part of that then. To go back to talk about some of the other pieces coming up on April 24th, could you tell us a little bit about those pieces? What can people expect to see there?
Well, we're going to start out with a work of Richard Carrick called La Touche Sonore sur l'eau, which is actually the name of the whole concert, The Sonorous Touch. Mm-hmm. And that'll be performed by Taka Kigawa. Zosia DeCostri has a new work called Ducks. And then Sean Shepard, who's somebody I've known for many years, we're going to be doing a work of his called Preludes. And all three of those works are going to be played by Taka Kigawa. Then after intermission, Lisa Bielawa's The Trojan Women is going to be played by the Sonic String Orchestra. And my piece, Frescoes and Ash, was originally commissioned by the Los Angeles County Museum of Art in conjunction with a show, an art show that they had, Frescoes and Mosaics of Pompeii. And so each one of the movements represents a different mosaic or fresco. And it goes everything from street musicians who are pretty raucous to a very beautiful marine mosaic that depicts all of these fish swimming together. And the last one is called Ash. And I know this is radio, so you can't see it, but if I can describe it, the mosaic is of a most unusual skull. It's a skull that has ears. They look like bone ears. Mm. And it's almost humorous, but not quite. It's just bizarre enough to look somewhat frightening and somewhat humorous at the same time. But the piece itself is meditative.
Hmm. Interesting. So Sonorous Touch is the name of the concert series, I guess. Why
of
that one concert.
Yeah, the April 1st concert that we're going to be doing is called Offbeat Operas. And I really like that title because, well, we know what offbeat refers to, but in a musical sense, it also refers to something that's off the beat, not on the beat. And that consists of three composers, besides myself, William Anderson. And his piece is a setting of Juna Barnes. And Frank Brickle, and his piece is a setting of Ezra Pound. And the thing that unifies that program is that James Joyce, Juna Barnes, and Ezra Pound all knew each other and were friends and, and well, I hope they were friends. They knew each other, let's put it that way.
Is that unified reference to common figures something that's come up in the past in Cutting Edge series?
I like to have some overall unifying element, and very often that comes out of the music itself. I try and fit, you know, it's really like a crossword puzzle to try and fit the performers, the composers, and the works into the proper year, month, day. And out of that, there usually is some kind of common thread. I try not to have a theme and then pick composers and works to fit that theme. That just seems to me to be somewhat artificial. I really would rather have it come organically out of the works themselves. And we have done some things that used extra musical elements. For example, we did a series called Can Music Heal?, which was about the healing element of music, which is pretty mysterious. And I invited doctors and music therapists to join us in pre-concert talks. We also did a series about weavers called Woven Sound, and one about architects called The Shape of Sound. So those were using extra musical elements of other art forms and integrating it with the music.
So that's an interesting story behind the May 1st show, Offbeat Operas. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the intention behind having Sonorous Touch be the title piece for that show.
Richard Carrick says about La Touche Sonore sur l'eau is based on an extended study of Debussy's Jeu, including a harmonic melodic reduction and reinterpretation of his compositional layers. Je is never actually quoted in the piece, but it has inspired a new way to approach writing for the piano, combining resonant harmonies with a sensitivity to dynamics and projection. This method, a sonorous touch, was first developed in Submerge for piano and winds. So it's interesting too that Richard Carrick is using a musical reference, Je, in his work.
Yeah, no, it seems like throughout the entire show there's kind of a contact between music and then something else, whether that's literature, the sonorous touch, your piece Frescoes making contact with art. Sounds like this should be a good thing for a really exciting show for the audience to go see. I guess as a Joyce fan, I have to ask you if there's any chance of, I know you're inspired by Ulysses specifically, but have you thought about making, or have you made any pieces maybe in dialogue with some of his other works? Anything from like maybe something more calm than Dubliners, or maybe even something crazy like Finnegan's Wake?
I'm a huge Joyce fan, but it will take me the rest of my life to work through Ulysses operatically, because I've already set, this will be my fourth episode of Ulysses. The first, as I said, is the final, the Penelope episode. The second was the episode right before that, Leopold Bloom's Homecoming. Then I set Cyclops for chorus and actors and chamber ensemble, and now this one. And I will continue, and we'll probably set them all for larger ensemble, but this is my equivalent of The Ring. And you know, Ulysses is enough for one lifetime. Yes, Finnegan's Wake is fascinating, but next time around.
I mean, so it's interesting that you're working all the way through it, but not necessarily in a chronological order, it seems.
Well, I'm Jewish, so I start from the end. And actually, the hero of the book, Leopold Bloom, is Jewish. I just happen to love the Molly Bloom episode, so I started with that, not even actually thinking at that time that I was going to do other sections, but it was so stimulating. His words, I'm so glad to hear that you're a Joyce fan, because his words are music. They really are. They're poetry and musical, and the fact that he himself was a musician makes so much sense, because when you hear the book or his words read, sometimes what is enigmatic when you see it on the page somehow springs to life. And so as a writer, I just found him to be my ultimately inspiring writer, and just I want to continue with it.
At the same time, somebody quite different in terms of writing style from Thomas Jefferson. So who are some of the other sources that, but beyond like your specific commissions, for example, for LACMA, Who are some of the other writers who inspire you? And do they inspire you in the same kind of modernist way that Joyce might seem to? Or?
Well, Jonathan Swift is the other one. I always seem to center on the two Irish writers. But Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels has also been an obsession with me. This is now the third time I'm writing a different version of Gulliver's Travels. And I have two wonderful collaborators. It's going to be done in full production in 2017-18 season. And I set his A Modest Proposal, if you're familiar with that, I set that for tenor and orchestra. And now this will be, as I say, the third foray into Gulliver's Travels.
It kind of reminds me of the Lacma piece for The Skull with the Ear, since there's something kind of dark and grim about both of those, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, as you know, with A Modest Proposal, it's a very outrageous, preposterous premise. Yeah. However, the way Swift sort of seduces you into it is by saying, well, we want to eliminate poverty and we want to give some work to these women who have such large families. And the reason that I wanted to set it was actually that a dark reason, and that was that I think that the 21st century is a time when our cultures are basically eating our young, destroying our young. And this latest news from Syria, I think, only goes to underline the fact that here is a country that is destroying its children.
Yeah, pretty dark stuff.
And it's hard to do that. It's also not, I think, effective to do that in a preachy way. And so that's why I think Swift was so successful in taking, and of course in his time it was the poor in Ireland, yeah, that were being neglected. And so the way he approached it was through irony and sarcasm and humor. And I think that, you know, that's a way of getting the message across, and all of a sudden when it's too late, you understand what it's really about.
I guess if those are important to getting the message across, how do you, like, obviously it's a lot harder in music to make like a passage that's, oh, that was an ironic passage, or, oh, that was a sarcastic passage. Like, you can definitely sometimes hear things and go, oh, that was so silly, or that sounded so whimsical, that must have been referring to a joke. But I guess, how do you develop the musical vocabulary that you need to retain these works?
What a great question. What I did was I used nursery rhymes. Mm. And I thought that that was the ultimate irony when he talks about eating children and you're hearing a nursery rhyme. I think that says it all.
Interesting. So that kind of gets back to the found object idea that you're interested in, too, these kind of pieces and these things you just kind of find in the music, I guess. As a conductor, sometimes maybe it's a little hard to see the audience's reaction, but when you do get to, I guess, how do people react when all of a sudden they kind of stumble on these objects?
That's one of those aha moments that you just live for.
Yeah.
When something like that occurs, you just say, thank you, this is a gift.
Sounds like it's especially something that's one of the interesting parts of getting to have a small kind of intimate space. As we were talking about for symphony space. Well, that seems like a pretty good note to end on. But before we do, just again to go over this specific concert series. So there's three shows. There's two left for people to go and see. They can go see them. One of them is at Symphony Space.
No, they're both.
They're both at Symphony Space.
In the Thalia Theater.
All right. And the dates for those, we have one on May 1st. It's Offbeat Operas, and then there was another on
April 24th.
And how can people, what's the best way to get tickets
for the
show?
They can either go to our website, www.cuttingedgeconcerts.org, or they can go directly to the Symphony Space website and click on April 24th and May 1st and get their tickets directly.
And after this concert series, what is next for Victoria Bond?
I'm working on Gulliver's Travels. We'll have a workshop in the fall. And the first Lilliput has already been done. And so we've got three other lands still to do. And then I teach again at the Conductors Institute in the summertime. And I also wanted to say that I'm teaching at Nyack College. I'm teaching a class in music appreciation and having a wonderful time. And also the Nyack College Chorus is performing my choral work based on Gerard Manley Hopkins, another poet who I just love. And that's tomorrow night at Lincoln Center.
So that'll be, what's the date today?
Today is the
6th. So that'll be on the 7th. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And all this right. may air after that.
It probably will. But it's good to be in the know about what's been going on. It's been really great getting to sit down and talk with you about your inspirations, about the ideas behind the show or concert series with a fairly rich history. Can't thank you enough for having come down. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Pleasure being here.